Hey everyone, welcome to Wire Talks, the Wire podcast, where we discuss all things crypto. This is your host, Thomas Scaria. I work here at Wire. Thank you so much for listening. So whether you're a veteran or a crypto noob, we're here to learn the ecosystem together. So there are no stupid questions. We'll try to avoid as much jargon as possible. And today, it's really my pleasure to talk about the current state of decentralized exchanges. Really a topic that we don't stop talking about at the office. So something we have to tackle really in the first couple episodes of the podcast. Today, I'm joined by Mike Dunworth, the CEO of Wire, and Louis Aboud, head of research and fund manager at Wire Capital. Guys, welcome to the podcast. I think together you guys bring a lot of expertise into this space, but coming from different angles, really, right? Mm-hmm. Mike, of course, we know it's been running Wire for about 5 years now. Louis, kind of a new face on this podcast, if you will. Louis, can you give us a little bit about your background and how you got into crypto?
Yeah, so I was at a long short equities hedge fund in Australia, basically covering all of their tech stock, software companies, medical technology companies, things like that. And I started looking at Bitcoin as a technology probably around 2011 when it came out in the news that somebody basically hacked a bunch of Australian government computers and turned them into a botnet for mining Bitcoin. And when that botnet got shut down and the hash rate halved, the price of Bitcoin crashed from, I think, like $3 to around 10 cents or something like that. And then kind of followed the markets. And then in the bubble of late 2013, really started getting interested in trading the asset. And I've known Mike for a few years. As you can tell, I'm also an Aussie. In early 2017, we started talking about launching a fund under the Wire brand because we felt like we were in a excellent position to execute knowing what we know about the industry and traditional finance.
Yep. Louis really brings a lot of finance expertise and has a deep understanding of financial primitives as we see them kind of evolve in the Ethereum ecosystem. And by financial primitives, I mean, you know, the basic building blocks of what is looking like a new open permissionless banking system, if you will, that's kind of popping up on Ethereum. So it's really a pleasure to have you on the podcast, Louis. So just to dive straight into it, we're going to be, like I said, talking about decentralized exchanges today. Let's quickly define what a decentralized exchange is. So, Mike, do you have a quick and dirty definition for us?
Yeah, I mean, a decentralized exchange is basically, it's a software platform that is not going to have like a central company. It's basically run and operating by a smart contract most of the time. So it's sort of a way for me to keep custody of my own assets, but still be able to trade in what feels like an exchange.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anything you'd add, Louis?
I mean, that is the gist. Yeah. In the common definition is basically not having to give custody of your funds to a third party so they can't rob you or be hacked. And I think a broader definition that is arguably more interesting is basically a trading system without a single point of failure.
Yep. So it's a peer-to-peer trading protocol that functions on a smart contract platform. You know, smart contract platforms like Ethereum are inherently decentralized. You put something like an exchange on a smart contract, and of course, you take out issues like custody and things like that. Mm. So, Mike, we've really witnessed a lot of like hacks and things just happen in the space over several years. I'm sure you've personally like witnessed Mt. Gox and, you know, the Bitfinex hack. Yeah. And all those different things. Mm. And they happen on centralized exchanges.
Yeah.
Right. So what are some of the issues behind centralized exchanges and this concept of counterparty risk?
Yeah. Like, and that's the thing. People don't really think about that. They think like, all right, cool. I'm going to put my money on Mt. Gox because any trader that back in the day they traded Mt. Gox, like, did you guys trade on Mt. Gox ever?
I found that I signed up for an account, but I don't think I ever traded on there, thankfully. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Mt. Gox had a 10% premium. Like, that was common knowledge that oh, if Bitcoin is $900, Mt. Gox is $990. That was just par for the course. But all this stuff, when it comes to counterparty risk, people are like, oh no, okay, so I've checked out their like, yeah, they've got really good security policies and shit. No, Bitcoin is like this whole different beast where it's not just about security. You got to check top to bottom. You got to check everything. You've got like, you know, what are the founders like? What are the founders' intentions? Do they want to build a big honeypot and gain a lot of, you know, credibility and then do a runner? Or, you know, who are their investors? All these things tell a story of kind of like how, you know, is this counterparty, you know, someone that I'm storing my money with? And if you're like us, sometimes there are other people's money that you're storing as well for trade execution or whatever. But like, I remember, this is really funny actually. I remember there was like price premiums, right? And price premiums are usually the most obvious thing in the space. And price premiums usually come from a lack of liquidity. So if I start a new exchange tomorrow, maybe there's not much liquidity, which means people might feel like there's arbitrage opportunities. So people rush to these exchanges, but usually that's because people, they've got a bad, like they don't have a reputation or they're doing something sort of shonky behind the scenes to attract trading activity. So I'll give you an example, right? So 3 years ago when we first started doing some of the arbitrage stuff at Wire, sorry, this is a short answer, but basically like talking about like counterparty risk. So the guys were like, Mike, we need to add BTC into our like, you know, aggregated bunch of exchange partners. And I was like, okay, sure, why? And they were like, oh look, like it's so stupid, we're not even making like this 1.5% money that we can be making every single time. And like in a world of, you know, currency exchange and stuff like that, making 1% margin is a huge deal. You know, that's a ton of margin essentially. Like you're trying to sell a dollar for a dollar and 1 cent. So like anytime you can find more margins is super important. Anyway, these guys, basically the team, they were saying, yes, we should do it. And I said, okay, no worries guys. If you can come back and show me a photo of the founders and a photo of what their office looks like and where it is, I will sign up and I will put, I'll put my money behind it. Not that I have much money, but basically I'll put my my rent money towards it. Yeah, and sure enough, 48 hours later, like 48 hours, there's like, they can't come up with an answer. I mean, that's pretty indicative of that in itself.
Yeah, hot tip. If there's a massive price premium on an exchange, it probably means you can't get your fiat out, and so you have to buy Bitcoin to remove it from the exchange. That's been a common theme. I think that was, you know, in 2015 and 16, you know, a lot of crypto exchanges had banking woes. I think Bitfinex were probably the market leader in that regard.
Market leader in banking woes.
Yeah, hence why they created Tether and a few other things like that. But yeah, it goes to show that, you know, if there are those opportunities out there, generally it means that there probably are issues of counterparty risk. That's why you'll see, you know, wide spreads on small exchanges that aren't trustworthy.
And
it's something to keep in mind.
And there's like a, sorry, Thomas just gave a hand motion like, yo, next thing, like let's talk about something else. This is meant to be a quick question. But yeah, for those that don't know, like, I mean, 2017, when there was this crazy bull run in like April, May, June, like the start of it, one of the really interesting things, if you go back and look at the price of Ethereum, there was at one point, it was like 32% premium to buy Ethereum in South Korea versus buying it, you know, in North America or Hong Kong or whatever. And that was basically referred to as the kimchi premium. But the reason why that premium exists is because people are like, oh, I'm just going to like go sell all my stuff on Ethereum, like sell all my Ethereum on the exchange and then I'll just wire the money back. I've got a friend in there. No, there's a $25,000 limit that the country restricts to, I don't know if it's 25 grand, but basically it's regulatory arbitrage.
They have capital controls, but this also has nothing to do with counterparty risk. So,
No, but it has. That's true. It doesn't. Thomas told me to ramble on for an hour. I think so.
Doing an excellent job.
Yes. It was more the price discrepancy. Yeah. So you get your money stuck essentially. So
yeah, right.
You can magnify the counterparty risk.
The issues always really come back to trust, right? Mm-hmm. When you're dealing with these centralized exchanges, what's happening is you're depositing Bitcoin or USD or whatever into their honeypot or bank account. And every trade that you're making is just a mark on their ledger, much like how traditional banking works. It's exactly
it's a database entry.
It's just a database entry, right? And then the powerful thing about DEXs is it's an entry that's made on the public blockchain, and the assets really never leave your wallet until they're truly being traded.
Right? And there's cryptographic proof that when they do leave it, the only conditions of them leaving your wallet is if this comes back. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. So, Louis, on a technical level, how do DEXs operate? There's a lot of different philosophies and ways a DEX can kind of overcome some of the inherent transparency issues, really, of the blockchain as well. And just a lot of different players out there. Do you have a good overview of the space?
So, I mean, the general gist of how they achieve the reduction of counterparty risk is basically what Mark was saying around not sending your Ether or BTC or any other cryptocurrency to an address that the exchange has total control over, but rather you send it to a smart contract. And there are particular conditions in which that money can be traded or returned to you. In terms of the different models, there are a lot of different sort of architectures that have been implemented to date. And the key differences between them is basically where do the orders get matched and how are the transactions settled. You can do everything on chain, which is basically where every single posted order or amended order actually gets submitted to the blockchain. And if you know anything about the issues with scalability in blockchains, that might raise a red flag, because basically it means that every single time that any trader does anything, you're getting multiple entries to the blockchain.
Yep.
And that can be a very expensive and slow way of...
Yep. As soon as you place the order, cancel the order, anything,
change the
right?
order. Yeah. And the alternative to that is basically doing all of the order matching off-chain. So it's a slightly more centralized model. And this is kind of the path that 0x and others have gone down, where effectively a relayer will run an order book under a certain set of rules in their own kind of little database.
Yep.
And then actual settlement of the trades, i.e. paying people what they should be getting based on the terms of the trade, all that happens on-chain.
Yeah.
And the key thing with the off-chain order books is you never actually give your money to the relayer in a way that you can't sort of get it back, right? All they're doing in the order matching process is basically figuring out who's doing what trade, but they can't simply abscond with your money.
Yeah.
You don't deposit anything. It never leaves your wallet. And the only time it does is when...
There are more hybrid models like IDEX, which is basically a company that's created... I guess there's a key distinction to be made between DEXs that are just protocols and DEXs that are kind of an arm of a company or simply that company's whole business. IDEX is a sort of decentralized exchange application where you can trade without counterparty risk because you don't send your crypto to wallets that they control. You just send it to a smart contract. But, you know, that is a business that could be shut down, say, if it wasn't obeying regulations, KYC, AML requirements under certain circumstances, or trading unregistered securities.
Yeah.
Plenty of reasons why the government might have a crack at those kind of companies, and they do have single points of failure.
I feel like they get kind of bucketed into that, like Ether Delta would be decentralized exchange. Those guys kind of where they take that hybrid model, sort of more of like non-custodial exchange, basically.
Yeah,
where they sort of...
And that's what, you know, I think you'll see pretty much every centralized exchange will make some kind of play into the decentralized world. And what that'll look like originally is, in the first instance, basically all of the current infrastructure they have will still be used, excluding the custody aspect.
Yeah.
So they'll basically, you know, like Ethernex or Binance's DEX will basically be the same order matching engine, all that same stuff that you like to use, like their fancy UI and order types. But
Binance
they won't.
Is fancy UI.
Well, maybe not them, but yeah. But yeah, you won't actually have to send them your money and completely relinquish control over those funds in order to trade on their platform. So they'll make a non-custodial version of their existing exchange. Mm-hmm. And that's probably where you see the best user experience to begin with.
Yep.
Rather than going, you know, the more decentralized you get, generally the user experience gets worse. Doing all of the orders, order matching on chain is basically going to be the slowest, most expensive, most frustrating, and probably most illiquid venue for trading. Doing the settlement on chain, but the order matching off chain, kind of like 0x, is a slight improvement on that.
Yeah.
And then going all the way down to the non-custodial centralized exchange model, which is what will feel nice, but have its own unique counterparty risk.
Right, right. And I like that you brought up the centralized exchanges getting into the decentralized exchange game.
Mm.
What's interesting about that is they actually have users, right? So they can, they may be able to, and they also have like KYC AML processes to for onboarding those users, which is kind of a missing a thing from a lot of the totally decentralized protocols like 0x or Kyber or AirSwap.
Yeah.
And what happens is that those same protocols have pretty spotty liquidity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is this like a chicken and egg problem? What do you see? What are some of the issues surrounding those kind of decentralized exchanges?
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm like, I keep barking about this. Like, I've been talking about this internally and like stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if you open an exchange, like when these, like, you know, the offshore exchanges come to the US, for example,
mm-hmm.
Like if we're ever talking to them about doing like market making or something, the reason why you have a market maker is so that you open your doors and it doesn't look like a ghost town. There's activity. And if I wanted to book a trade, I can book a trade. And like market maker is like this critical ingredient. And I've used this a couple of times in the office, but it's kind of like buying a, like owning a nightclub and refurbishing it all and all that stuff.
Oh boy.
Everyone's looking at me like, go fuck yourself. But no, hear me out for one sec. All right. Market makers, nightclub owner. So a market, if I start a nightclub, I'm going to have I want to get, you know, guys and girls and all that stuff to get there. So I offer, let's say, like a happy hour that's going to get more people, you know, coming to the club and all that sort of stuff, whatever it is. And you want a balance between, you know, you don't want 1,000 guys there and, you know, 5 girls or 5,000 girls and, you know, 1 guy or whatever it is.
Right.
You need balance. And that's what market makers are. But in that world, they're called, you know, promoters. And their job is to, hey, bring all your friends. We've got this big night coming up. It's our launch night. Market makers, same thing. All they do, they just provide buys and sells, and the exchange says, hey, thanks so much for providing a lot of liquidity, buys and sells on either side. You make our, you know, our exchange look alive. We're going to give you rebates on fees. So yeah, but they can't operate. The market makers, so back to the point, because I love getting away from the point. I think, were you about to open your mouth and start sort of shutting me off, Louis? This happens so much.
Not.
No. Yeah, but okay, so back to the point. Like market makers can't market make on decentralized exchanges because there's no AML and KYC. Whether you like it or not, that's just the fact. These guys are moving millions of dollars. 99% of them that are worth having market make.
This guy. Dude.
That's his hot tip coming in for the ETF approval.
Oh, there you go.
I'm joking.
You're not supposed to say that on air.
Soz. But like you look at a market maker. Market makers, they are big shops, like the ones that are, you know, doing it seriously, and they're regulated. They have an obligation to know the other person on the other side. And if they don't know the other person on the other side, they would need to know that someone does. essentially. Yeah. So like, I mean, in that example, it's sort of like trading on Ether Delta, trading on local Bitcoins. Probably not. Like if, you know, if Cumberland gets a $5 million order to buy Bitcoin and there's a really good price for $5 million to buy Bitcoin on local Bitcoins, I'm kind of guessing that they're not going to execute that order. That's because they've got no idea who it is. So I think that's a big thing in that, like, you just, just look at the whole market.
Yeah.
Before, like, exchanges with AML and KYC procedures got going, it's just turned, like, poured gasoline on the fire. Like, the volumes are just insane.
Right, right. I mean, how would you explain that situation to regulators, right, Mike? Like, how are you supposed to explain to the SEC that you went and found the other side of the trade, but you don't know who it is, where it came from? It could have been from like a terrorist group or something like that, God forbid. So that's why
Osama's
KYC...
stockpiling EOS. He's the bag holder.
the reality is that if you don't have KYC and AML procedures, but you do allow the trading of assets, then you're basically going to attract all of the bad players in the industry. So there's a kind of negative selection aspect to it where, you know, if they are kind of a hole in the regulatory ecosystem, then, you know, you can almost guarantee that if you're making markets on one of these platforms, that
you're shoveling the shit for
someone. You're trading against Kim Jong-un and the rest of them, right?
Does he still trade? Yes, badly.
Yeah.
That Kimchi premium. Right. Yeah.
So some obvious cons of decentralized exchanges are there's no proper KYC AML procedures in place. It's kind of against almost like the ethos of a decentralized exchange. And
That said, sorry to interrupt, but that said, I think it's super important, like, in the same way, like, AML and KYC is important if you want whales to trade and execute, but, you know, people that want their privacy and stuff like that, I mean, I feel like they should be able to trade amongst themselves in that capacity. If I'm, like, a retail trader and I'm trading my, you know, my two Ethereum tokens, yeah, maybe I don't want to submit AML and KYC because it's an exhausting process for $500. But I think it's like, you know, the more serious it gets, you never want to wave that flag because, like, it just, there's no point in doing it. It's so interesting looking at all, like, the pictures of decentralized exchanges, how it's like, no AML, no KYC. It's like, dude, you're scaring away every whale that wants to trade on you with no counterparty risk.
Yeah. In the crypto hierarchy of needs, I'd say that, you know, not giving your coins to somebody else, i.e. maintaining custody of your private keys, is at the top. In terms of, like, maintaining privacy and economic freedom, which, you know, might be issues if you implement KYC and AML procedures, I think that that is below the counterparty risk element on the hierarchy of needs. But, you know, there's still people that will value that so highly that they just won't trade under any other circumstances. But that's always going to be a small percentage of the market.
Yep.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, I really like, Mike, that you brought up all of the issues surrounding whales kind of getting into the space. And you know, another thing that whales really don't like is they don't like getting front run, right? And they don't like having massive slippage on a $5 million Bitcoin order. Right. What are some other issues with the current state of decentralized exchanges for those types of traders?
I'm glad you asked that. I'm going to delegate that to Louis, who's frothing to talk about it.
Look, DEXs are going to face a whole bunch of problems. I think the one that, you know, there are a few other downsides to DEXs beyond, you know, front-running risks and things like that. Scalability and, like, gas costs and basically the cost to trade, I think, will be a growing problem for DEXs. You know, basically, if you're doing all of these on-chain transactions to settle trades or even post orders, you know, all of that fills up the transaction capacity of, you know, whether it's the Ethereum network or a different network. And, you know, generally speaking, when trading activity is at its highest, the demand for on-chain transactions will also be really high. So if you look at basically the number of on-chain transactions for Ethereum or Bitcoin in late 2017 was really high and transaction fees were really high. And a lot of that was related to the amount of trading volume. But, you know, the other issue is basically even doing off-chain order matching, you're going to have capacity issues. You know, pretty much every centralized exchange went through big growing pains. You know, Kraken, BitMEX, Coinbase, they all struggled to keep up with demand in 2017. DEXs are going to suffer all those same problems when they start getting popular, but it's just going to be much, much worse because
the chain's got to scale, not the service.
Yeah, the chain has to scale, but also, you know, all these 0x relays, if they're doing lots of volume, you know, they're going to be a much more capital constrained company. They're not really going to have the same money to invest in building all these systems to handle the amount of trading activity. And they'll probably trade a much larger range of markets because part of the nature of DEXs is that you have all of these kind of smaller esoteric tokens trading. So you're going to have basically probably more going on and much less capacity and much larger scalability problems. So it'll be, you know, it's possible that a DEX actually breaks Ethereum in terms of the amount of capacity on the network to process trading activity. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, both in terms of the on-chain capacity and also off-chain scalability. Another major downside, which isn't really talked about much, is basically that the actual trading functionality you get on decentralized exchanges is much more limited relative to some of the leading centralized exchanges. You know, Bitfinex have peer-to-peer lending markets and advanced order types and all of this kind of stuff that DEXs don't really have.
It's super clunky. I would describe it as dog shit, actually.
Yeah, I mean, just like the general experience is worse, but you can also do a lot less as a trader on these decentralized exchanges. Granted, like, you know, a lot of the 0x relayers and like market aggregators such as Total are looking to implement, you know, decentralized derivative products and things like DYDX, Dharma, Lendroid, all that kind of stuff, which will bring the decentralized exchanges more sort of closer to par in terms of functionality. But that's going to take a long time. And the reality is that most whales, you know, trade on margin. They manage their exposure, you know, with derivatives. If you can't do any of that on decentralized exchanges, those people simply won't trade there.
Yeah, yeah.
And do you, here's an interesting thought, actually, just as you were talking about that. So if I'm a trader at a company, right, and my job is to, you know, make trades at a fund or whatever, and is there enough incentive for me to give a shit about if the exchange goes down, then we lose our money, or like to move over to a decentralized exchange? Do you know what I mean? Like if it's my money, yeah, I mean, I'm going to be more concerned about it. But if I'm trading on behalf of some big fund, like, would they give a shit?
I think it depends who the counterparty is. I think if the alternative to trading on a DEX is trading on some massive money laundering scheme like BTCE, then the risk is probably sufficient for you to cop all of the downsides to trading on a DEX. But, you know, if the counterparty's solid and they're, you know, insured, qualified custodian and all of the, have all the trappings of a, you know, regulated financial intermediary, then, you know, I think people would probably value the liquidity is the biggest thing, because that's basically defines the cost of trading and all the other functionality. Yeah, so I'd say overall, you know, people lean towards centralized exchanges probably more over time as the counterparties improve in quality.
And all the bells and whistles, the insurance and the custody.
Exactly. It's going to become harder to compete for DEXs because, you know, everybody was super bullish on DEXs kind of 2016, 2017. That whole concept seemed super valuable because, you know, most of the volume was happening on Bitfinex and nobody trusted them. And, you know, there were all these kind of fundamental issues with where Bitcoin actually traded. And that will become less of a problem
over time. You know, granted, we're talking kind of high level here, and some would argue that the kind of financial intermediaries entering the space bring new kinds of unforeseen risks. Let's probably not get into all of that, but like when you start talking about bearer assets being subject to things like rehypothecation.
What the fuck does rehypothecation? Mate, hold on. I can't even type that out. What does it mean?
So basically, in the hedge fund industry, the way that prime brokerage works is that a prime broker basically facilitates the borrowing and lending of its customers' assets for the purpose of like shorting and things like that. And rehypothecation is basically where I allow my prime broker to re-lend the assets that I own to their other clients, and then basically they'll reduce the fees that I have to pay them, like the interest for borrowing stuff. Long story short, this probably doesn't make any sense, but basically what that means is that most hedge funds trade other hedge funds' assets without really knowing. Everything's commingled, and you can have situations where assets are being traded and nobody actually owns them. People are selling stock that nobody owns, right? Yeah. This kind of all these problems will be worse in a Bitcoin world because we're talking about bearer assets here. Nice. I'm not sure if anybody's going to understand what I'm talking about.
No, I'm glad you explained it for everyone. I wanted you to explain it for everyone else because obviously I know what it means, but
Google rehypothecation, folks.
Yeah, no,
it's interesting.
Google how to spell rehypothecation, then Google what does rehypothecation mean.
I haven't heard that word for several years. I heard it probably when I took my Series 7 like 6 years ago, and then now it's popping up all the time because of the Bitcoin ETF and the implications of like banks holding Bitcoin on their balance sheet and things like that. And it's basically double counting.
Yeah, Caitlin Long, who writes for Forbes, has written a few pieces on the financialization of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. Yeah. And basically, it's all of the things that crypto tried to
avoid
around basically not knowing who you who your counterparties are and what you owe them, and kind of not having transparency over all of these interlinked claims over other people's assets, which is the problem you get in traditional finance. All of those problems will be reintroduced into this industry as traditional players enter the market. So that's a very long-winded and roundabout way of saying that as new financial institutions do come into the market,
they bring their
there'll be
with them.
Yeah, there'll be new risks. I think you're seeing guys like Antonopoulos and Szabo basically saying a Bitcoin ETF is not really a good thing. That's not why we're here. I think that's going to become a growing issue.
But the price is going to go up if it gets announced.
Exactly.
Dude, you know what? People don't deserve the price to go up. Fucking build shit. That's what it's sort of like an indicator. No, build some cool shit, then we'll take a look at it.
So certainly a lot of headwinds for DEXs as they're operating in a fiat.
Oh, is that what we were talking about?
I was like, wait, what was the ending of Jumanji? Like,
that's good. So, how do you envision this all playing out, knowing that the two worlds are sort of colliding? Hopefully KYC and AML is going to be slowly brought into the DEX ecosystem. We're seeing more on ramps and easy ways to get into that ecosystem and out of that ecosystem as well. How do these two worlds kind of come together? What's your vision of trading technology for the future?
There's some look at the OTC market. I think from my experience, which is none, but being in crypto for however long, it seems to me, it all starts at the OTC level for the most part. Liquidity, who's trading where. And I think like OTC is fascinating to me because 40% or some statistic or some shit, I read like 40% it was like 40% of the trading volume is done OTC. And it's fascinating. We're all trading this digital currency, trustless technology, yet okay, I'll send you a $2 million wire and please make sure you send the Bitcoin right after you get it. Like, it's not decentralized. We're trading on a decentralized technology.
Right.
We're just big, fat counterparty honeypots.
The biggest irony.
Is it? Ever. Seriously.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to be a massive thing. And I think a lot of people are going to do OTC trading trustlessly.
Yeah.
But, you know, high throughput decentralized exchanges. People are looking at me like I'm a fucking idiot. What are you looking at? All right. Fill me in. I'm missing it.
Yeah. So that's exciting. Decentralized OTC desks, right? So you really envision that kind of technology, like filling that
gap? I mean, it's the easiest. There's no throughput issues. There's no like high frequency, like all those kind of things that come with, you know, traditional, the advantages of traditional centralized exchanges. That's...
Yeah. Yeah. Are you seeing any interesting projects in that space?
Well, I think on the OTC front, it's not really a decentralized OTC desk, but Republic Protocol are building a dark pool protocol. And basically, that's a concept from traditional finance, where it's basically an order book where you can submit orders and nobody really gets to see what orders you've submitted. So nobody gets to see what you're doing, but you can get filled within like a certain price range. So it's basically a way for whales to trade against each other without revealing what they want to do. So it's a way of basically doing big trades without pushing the market around, which is, you know, it's a problem in crypto because the markets aren't actually that liquid.
Interesting. How does the order matching happen in a trustless, decentralized way where all the, you know,
so you're gonna make me embarrass myself trying to explain multi-party computation on the air. But basically what happens is that bits of the data that make up the orders are broken up into pieces and then sent to all of the nodes on the network, and then they have to kind of match the pieces together to match the orders. That's kind of the lay
Bullish.
Explanation of it. Yeah.
That.
I don't know
if head of research.
You can probably do a better job.
No, I mean, look, my brain's dead today. I think it's Thursday. I'm like, yeah, I'm cooked. But no, like, I think Republic Protocol is, I mean, there's a lot of buzz, there's a lot of noise around it because dark pools, you know, that's not a thing yet. And I think they're onto something like, just generally, OTC is the easiest, the lowest barrier to entry, essentially, in if it is kind of regulated, or not regulated, but just say, I know who the counterparty is. An OTC desk, they'll trade 5 million, 10 million, 20 million, 30, they don't care, as long as they know the other person. So, you know, mechanisms putting that in place is going to push stuff ahead. And, you know, that's stuff that we look at internally, obviously, because we don't want to hold money with bunch of people if we don't have to. But yeah, like, you know, look at AirSwap, they're starting out doing that sort of stuff, and then Republic is, I think Republic's got a really interesting token model, and I know we've talked about it a bunch internally as well.
I think there's something worth noting about the OTC model for DEX is that it's particularly suited to cross-chain transactions.
Yes.
You know, if you're putting stuff in an off-chain order book, kind of like 0x, becomes much harder to deal in cross-chain transactions. But if you're doing kind of one-to-one trading in a kind of OTC sense, then, you know, baking in a kind of atomic swap kind of functionality into that style of trading becomes a whole lot more viable. Which is something, you know, Republic can do, for example, will be able to do sort of ETH BTC trading in a decentralized way, for example. And that would be a big win for DEXs to see that implemented in like a nice, liquid, scalable way.
Yeah. And that's it. That's the interesting thing, like why you don't see, so like atomic swaps being able to trustlessly go cross chain with assets, but you only see them like in a one-to-one capacity. So like, here's 1,000 ETH, give me one Bitcoin because Bitcoin's so much better than Ethereum. A really interesting problem to solve is, you know, one-to-one atomic swaps is awesome. But what about like end-to-end atomic swaps, like, you know, a big pool of Bitcoin and a big pool of Ethereum where I can delegate my little slice of the pool to get, you know, 10 slices of your Ethereum pool or whatever the ratio is. Anyway, that's interesting, but
I think there's a flip side to this discussion, which I think is really interesting and not really talked about at all, which is how crypto-based DEX protocols can introduce decentralized trading on traditional assets. So if you look at something like Market Protocol, they basically allow you to create a CFD or like futures contract on any asset that you can get a price feed / Oracle for. So you'll be able to, for instance, margin trade Apple stock based on these smart contracts in a totally decentralized way, up until the extent at which an Oracle can be decentralized. And there are some people out there that
have like decent, you know, data integrity behind it.
Yeah. Which is, you know, a problem that needs to be solved, but I think it will be solved in time. But, you know, I think that you'll actually see kind of like Augur, you'll see a few DEX protocols basically allow for trading of traditional assets in a way that wasn't technically possible with traditional financial infrastructure.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, arguably a much larger market to absorb than the other way around.
I think those are some really interesting points you guys bring up. But just to like shift gears a little bit, how do you really think that the next million users are going to enter the DEX ecosystem?
Are you going to take this one first, Mike?
You mean enter the crypto ecosystem or the DEX ecosystem? Like, how do you get the people?
Yeah, how do you get grandma to start using a decentralized exchange instead of Fidelity?
Right? You know what? I'm sick of my grandma calling me saying, how the fuck do I use a decentralized exchange? Answer my call. What up, Nan? If she's listening, she's not listening. sorry. How do you get million users using decentralized exchanges?
Yeah, the next wave.
All right, the next wave
of adoption.
Well, firstly, solve the slippage issue. Mm-hmm. Firstly, solve a volume issue, then worry about slippage. Because you can have a lot of volume and just a ton of slippage as well. At least there's volume, let alone, you know, slippage. You try and put a $10,000 order in, it says, sorry, the maximum order is $6,300.
Right.
That's the first thing. Second thing, have a mega, mega centralized exchange get hacked. If you wanted, like, I'm not saying this is what I want. Like, how do you get a million users to use DEXs?
Right. Yeah.
That'll be a big thing. Here's one thing, and I know, Lou, you're about to start talking. Just let me explain this. People think, this is what some people don't realize, is that Mt. Gox got hacked and call it, 500,000 users. I don't know how many, maybe 750,000. And $500 million worth of Bitcoin was, you know, busted open. And people start measuring hacks by the amount of money that was stolen. That's not really what you should be measuring it by. You should be measuring, because it's like how impactful it is. Obviously, money is incredibly important, but like measure it by how many pissed off people are going to be on the other side of it. So if I get hacked, like if an exchange gets hacked and I'm a trader and I lose my $10,000 balance, I'm going to be pissed. If I lose $2,000, I'm going to be pissed. Like, period. So now the ecosystem isn't, you know, a million people anymore. Coinbase has, you know, 30 million users. Like, that is more pissed off people, and that is more mouths that are going to talk, and that is more mouths that are going to talk to people that are going to want to find an answer to not have that happen to them again. And that will drive people to learn about self-custody.
Yeah.
I don't want that to happen, obviously. There's a better way to get there, but it's just
What do you think, Louis?
Look, I think in the long term, like a lot of things with this technology, it'll get mass adoption when people don't even know that they're using that technology. I think that the first million will come from the broad user base of centralized exchanges participating in DEXs as those companies like Coinbase and Binance kind of shift their back end towards a more trustless architecture. So like over time, things will naturally become less custodial and more decentralized. And all those, you know, Coinbase has over
20 million users, 24 million users or something like that.
Yeah.
Binance has, you know, users in the millions.
Yeah.
They could very easily push DEXs in general to over 10, 20 million users. And so that's probably where it comes from in my mind.
Yeah, ish. I mean, I think so. I agree. I think they'll definitely be able to push it. But what they will probably do is more of a self, like a non-custodial model. In that, like, I don't know if you guys saw what Bitfinex was bringing out. These guys are discussing certain notes. Basically, Bitfinex, they were demonstrating at their hackathon. They gave like a teaser to a centralized exchange having what appeared to be some kind of non-custodial solution. And obviously, Bitfinex is a monster. So that could pave the way, which is sort of depending on people's definition of decentralized exchanges or non-custodial exchanges. But
yeah. That's really interesting. So do you think this is like a winner take all scenario, or is there room for different types of players in this ecosystem?
I think, you know, obviously there are a lot of different DEXs out there today. I think it does consolidate a bit, but there will be sufficient ways that protocols can be differentiated and offer truly different or unique trading experiences. And that the amount of sort of differentiated trading experiences will probably define the amount of big players in the space. And they might all come from one team or kind of DEX brand, like 0x might, you know, basically fork Republic's code and build all of that functionality into their protocol or like an adjacent protocol. You might see something like that, but you know, I think in the long term there'll probably be three or four different winners in the DEX space that kind of all do different things. You know, whether it's trading on chain or you know, running a dark pool. So, you know, these things are fundamentally incompatible, and that probably leads to a few surviving in the long term.
Well, that's great, guys. I think we covered a ton of ground today. Thank you for joining, Louis. Thank you for joining, Mike. It's really a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Sweet.
No, I've got plenty more to talk about.
Shut the fuck up.
Thanks, Mike.
No, thanks for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Cheers. Cheers. So thank you for joining us today. To learn more about DEXs, check out the show notes included in your podcast and remember to subscribe to get the latest episodes. If you have any questions or comments, reach out to us on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Morse code, Wireblog, whatever works for you. If you like this episode, share it on Facebook and LinkedIn and Twitter with all your friends and colleagues. And thanks again for listening.
Well read, Tom. Thanks, guys.